Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He's my good buddy and digital marketer extraordinaire. His name is Eric Sue. Eric, welcome back to the show, my friend.
George, always a pleasure to be here. Always good to see you, man.
Yeah, now, with the Rebel Capitalist Show, we always talk about macroeconomics, we talk about freedom, we talk about liberty, but it's also about entrepreneurship. And I like to interview people like yourself that are incredibly, not only just well-known, but very successful entrepreneurs in your own right, to kind of do some digging and see how you got to where you are, but what you're seeing in the landscape right now, because a lot of my viewers and listeners, although they're really interested in the macro and in the freedom and liberty stuff, a lot of them are entrepreneurs or aspiring to be an entrepreneur. They're very self-sufficient. So I really want to kind of dive in and pick your brain today. Let's start by going over kind of your quick backstory to get everyone up to speed if they didn't see our first interview.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a marketer, podcaster, own an agency called Single Grain, have about 60 employees for that company. And the podcast we do is called Marketing School. I do it with another marketer named Neil Patel, and that's a daily marketing podcast. And then aside from that, that's kind of related to the show. I do invest, you know, a good chunk into Web3, and happy to talk about that. That's the world of kind of crypto, and then also invest into startups as well. And then kind of hedging against the future too. Happy to talk about this as well. But you know, looking at, you know, when we think about our balance sheet, right, in terms of protecting against inflation and things like that, thinking about how we're taking like a page from MicroStrategy, how we can, you know, put some Bitcoin on the balance sheet too. So just a handful of things there. But I just think entrepreneurship is just one of the best ways, the best tickets to have that life of freedom that you talk about so often.
Yeah. And a lot of people, on the Rebel Capitalist channel, that's the second channel that I started. I don't know if we've ever even really discussed that one.
We have.
But I do live streams. And then periodically on that channel, I'll just kind of open up the kimono and do a live stream for everyone, anyone that really wants to watch, on starting their own YouTube channel. And I'll take them behind the scene and go to my analytics for both channels and to kind of show people what I did right and what I did wrong. And when, you know, the growth curve really started to accelerate with the George Gammon channel and the thumbnails and the titles. And I really just try to give people all the information. So if they so choose to start their own channel or create their own content, that they've got, you know, a little bit of a head start, and I reduce the learning curve. And I also like to do that because I think if people can see that, hey, if George can do it, then I can do it as well. But what I want to dive into next, though, is kind of you took the red pill, the economic red pill, so to speak, because you were in LA and you started the business. I'm sure you were like me back then, where you didn't know anything about the Fed. You didn't know about interest rates. All you were focused on is making money with your business. That's how I was before I retired.
That's exactly what happened. And so, by the way, like when the pandemic finally hit, I started watching your channel, and then I really started going down the rabbit hole. I'm like, I need to understand what the heck is going on. So you're right. Yes.
Yeah. So take us through that progression. I'm really interested to hear that story, because so many of us were where you were in 2020, me included. You know, I was there back in 2012 when I retired, and that's when it started for me. But what was kind of your red pill economic story there?
Yeah, I think when the money printer really started up, I mean, you know, I graduated college during the last, you know, financial crisis. And so I didn't really pay attention to that stuff. But then, you know, when I thought everything was crashing down, like I was panicking and everything, and then I just saw everything go straight up to the right, I was like, okay, now something's really going on. I need to pay attention to what's going on, because both my podcast co-host, again, like we've mentioned before pre-COVID that we don't really care about politics. We don't care about all these things. And then once it hit, it's like, oh, all this stuff matters. And then started watching more Robert Kiyosaki, and it's just understanding where you guys are coming from, the research that you guys are putting in, and then applying it to business too. Just understanding that nobody's going to come save you at the end of the day, and you have to think for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, Kiyosaki is going to be at the next Rebel Capitals Live.
Everyone has to go.
That's right. So just for the viewers and listeners, Eric is going to be a VIP guest there. And Kiyosaki, I just spoke with his assistant last week. He's going to be there as well. He's been at every single one. So it's just great to have him there. So then walk me through kind of the decision to move from California out to Miami. And did you take your whole team out there, and what kind of prompted that decision?
Yeah. So pre-COVID, I was already going to Miami like every quarter. So I just love it. And I was previously, we talked about on this podcast, moving to Puerto Rico, but I actually pulled everything back and then made the decision to come to Miami. And it's been the best thing ever, because a lot of people ask me, they're like, Eric, like, you came here for taxes, didn't you? I'm like, no, like, I came here for community. And I think one of the biggest points of leverage is that it's like freshman year of college, right? Where all the cool people in tech or crypto doing interesting things, everyone's down to hang out. And there's that, no roots are established yet. There's no clicks that are established yet. So there's that relationship arbitrage right now where you can build really deep connections. And I think that's worth way more. The taxes are great, but I think it's worth infinitely more than that long-term. Mm-hmm. So the level of people that I'm meeting right now is just amazing. And there's not a sense of ego. It's more sense of like, let's collaborate, let's build together, and let's continue to help make the world a better place.
Yeah. So you work just your business is more tech driven than my business was. So when I first got into or taking the economic red pill, if you will, I kind of gravitated towards kind of an old school approach with real estate or commodities or trying to buy things when they're very cheap. But you were kind of in that tech business to a certain extent already. So it sounds like when you kind of started to better understand money printing and the Fed, you kind of more gravitated towards crypto, Bitcoin, and now NFTs, which makes a lot of sense because that's kind of your area of expertise, the tech space. So it sounds like, correct me if I'm wrong, if that's the direction you went and why, but then kind of how has Miami helped you kind of open up your eyes to other opportunities in that space where you're maybe more comfortable?
Yeah, I think it's really important to, you know, just really studying the last couple of years, it's, you know, the wealthy own assets at the end of the day, and you let the assets work for you. And so for me in March of 2020, really in April of 2020, this is actually before even Michael Saylor started to plow into Bitcoin, I had started to do that, right? I'm just like, this makes a lot of sense. And so for me, you know, crypto, like I try to be fairly conservative, right? Like Bitcoin and Ethereum, to me, those are kind of more, you know, layer one infrastructure bets that seem to make more sense. Do I think it's going to be around for the next 10 years? Warren Buffett, if you're not going to hold it for 10 years, don't even hold it for 10 seconds. So I look at those much more as investing. I'm much more of a buy and hold guy. Right. NFTs, I see much more as speculation. So that's just me having fun. I don't see it as an investment, but I am still very buy and hold there. But to your point, I don't like owning stuff, right? Like for me, coming from like a gaming and a tech background, like it seems to make more sense to own, you know, JPEGs or crypto, because you can carry it with you pretty easily. Or over the years, the last 2 years or so, we've bought some other agencies too, and I understand those businesses well. So I'm just trying to buy in areas that I really understand, where I think I have an advantage. And, you know, not trying to own, I don't need to own like 20 or 30 different things, right? I just owning a small set of good stuff. And that's what it is.
How are you better understanding, like when you got into the space, how did you better understand crypto? And then what, then NFTs? And then how are you trying to further your learning there so you can have an edge?
Yeah. So in the world of starting really with crypto, kind of Bitcoin and Ethereum. So thankfully, for example, like, I don't know if you've had Pomp. Have you had Pomp on the show before?
No, I've been on his show.
Okay. Yeah. So definitely, I mean, at some point, you should definitely get him on. I mean, he lives like two blocks away from me, right? So there's like a
I should invite him to Rebel Capitalist Live. I didn't even think about that. I'll reach out to him on Twitter today.
That's a no-brainer. And if you need me to text him, I'm happy to help there too. But like, there's a great group of crypto friends here. So the people that actually do it, the other side of things is there are some great newsletters, right? So I subscribe to one newsletter called Milk Road, and it's free to subscribe. Hmm. And Bowtie Bull is another one. They talk about crypto, NFTs, and Ethereum a lot. So I read a lot and I talk to people, and they're a lot smarter than I am. And for me, it's like, okay, you know, other than that, I'll just look at network effects, right? So I'll use, you know, different tools out there that will show me kind of, you know, more users coming in. How are people holding over time? And you just look at it like it's the first time really in history where you can like look at, oh, more people are adopting it, more developers are building stuff on it. So it just makes a lot of sense. Like this stuff, network adoption, if it's just continuing to go up and to the right, it's like, okay, and do I believe in it? Do I actually use this stuff? And do I believe it's going to be there for long term? If the answer is yes, then, and I see real utility in it, then I'm probably going to just hold on to it. So I don't try to speculate with all these other coins, and I'm not trying to trade. And I'm just holding on to maybe like four or five assets in crypto, and that's it.
What is the elevator pitch for NFTs? Because I know for my audience, you know, again, it's maybe it's just an age thing too, because you know, you're a lot younger than I am. And so maybe we just grew up and, you know, we didn't have cell phones when I was growing up. So we didn't even have pagers until like, I don't know, probably like my last year of college or something like that. Something like that. So, I guess that would be the first question. Do you think it's a generational thing? And then for NFTs specifically, kind of what's the value proposition there? Because I went to a meetup in Puerto Rico with some guys that are really big in the NFT space. And I don't know that I was completely sold, but they have some angles on NFTs that most of my audience probably has never thought through, such as the smart contracts and whatnot, how you can sell them and get paid later into the future and whatnot. So I guess A, do you think that's a generational thing, an age deal? And then B, kind of what's the use case for, or the value proposition for NFTs?
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily a generational thing. I think it's one of those things where it's like, first you kind of like you think it's stupid, and then afterwards like you start to see it pick up. It's like, oh, it starts to make more sense, and it's like then you start maybe you're still making fun of it, and then it's like you finally like, you know, come into it, right? That's how I was initially. Like, pretty when I saw NFTs in Clubhouse, when I was hanging on Clubhouse, there's a lot of these NFT rooms. This was in late 2020, early 2021. Yeah. I was like, this is kind of stupid. But then I was like, I kind of get it. And then like 3 months later, I'm just like, okay, like if I really want to understand this stuff, I should just buy some and see where it goes. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, if I really want to understand this stuff, I'm just going to build one and really have the scar tissue and the experience behind it.
So you built an NFT.
Yeah. We launched one like about a month, 6 weeks ago. We did like about almost 500,000 in sales.
Explain that to me. Can you just walk me through that whole process from A to Z?
Yeah, sure. So, but before I do, I want to answer your question too. When you look at NFTs, I mean, when you're buying a home, really what you're buying at the end of the day is you're buying a piece of paper, right? You're buying the deed. If you have like a bunch of, you know, people that hate you move in and they say your home is mine, then you're pretty much screwed, right? So really what you're buying is a contract at the end of the day. And to your point, with NFTs, what you're really buying is you're buying like a digital signature to kind of authenticate that you do in fact own that piece, right? And you can see for the first time in history, you can see the provenance behind like anything digital, right? Where you couldn't before, you couldn't really verify like who made this, who owns it. Now you can. It's kind of digital property, right? Now, do I think 99% of this stuff is going to zero? Yes. Do I think 99% of the people in the space are very short-term driven and they're speculating? Yes. So largely like the things that I try to buy or hold are things that I think will be around for the long term. And I look at it much more of like angel investing, right? Do I believe in the team behind it? Do I think they can execute on whatever they're proposing? And that's what it is. So that's the answer to your question.
Okay.
And then now for our project, it's called Leveling Up Heroes. And for me, we're talking kind of pre-show. I really like connecting with people, right? So I like throwing dinners. I like doing events. I like attending events, and magic just happens, which is why I'm even in Miami. And you know, get good deal flow from that. You become lifelong friends. Like, just there's so much leverage you gain from that. And so my whole thing was like, I'm going to make an NFT, but it's going to be more like a membership NFT. And what that means is you'd get access to like, for example, our first event is happening next week in Austin at the W Hotel.
This is with you and Neil.
This one's just me.
Okay.
And Neil's going to be there too. Right. And by the way, you're welcome to come. But I'm going to do 3 events a year. I'm going to do quarterly dinners. And my whole thing too is, guys, like, we're going to connect with amazing people, 7 to 9-figure founders. And I'm going to share deal flow. We'll all share deal flow with each other so we can invest together. And then we can also make magic happen. So, and then there's like a larger conference where we have like speakers and things like that, which I'd love to have you come at some point.
So this is a mastermind group.
Yeah, it's basically a mastermind group. There's events. And then also there's like a handful of other benefits I've added into it. But the cool thing about this now is like, let's say, George, you buy an NFT and you decide at some point, like, okay, like I've gotten my use out of this. Like, I just want to sell it. You can sell it. And by the way, the ticket, like if the people value the event and they value the NFT higher, you might actually make a profit on your ticket, and someone else is going to get the benefit from that too, right? So you get to win from that. But also on the transaction, I might collect anywhere from 5 to 10% on the like a royalty there. So I continue to make money too over time, and I can reinvest it back into the initiative, or you know, I can just take profits.
Interesting. So it's like a golf club membership.
Yeah.
Like at a very kind of prestigious club where some of them you can actually sell your membership to someone else. And I know a lot of people, in fact, my brother-in-law has made quite a bit of money on, you know, he bought it just to play golf. And then 5 years later, you know, he moves somewhere, sells it, and the membership is worth double what he paid. But then with the NFT, you as the originator of the NFT and the head of the mastermind, you would get a kickback for that sale. If I'm understanding correct.
And that's like a very simple, like
that's built into the electronic contract.
Yeah. That's a simple, like that's a simple feature built into the smart contract, but also this, right? If you're holding the NFT and I say, hey, like if I'm trying to disincentivize you from selling or like give you more stuff for the long term, I might just say, hey, every year, George, like we're going to give you other benefits. I might release a very special NFT that only holders get. And I might release some other features that only holders get. Right. So that's kind of the benefit of having an NFT versus just having like a regular ticket, because I can just, it's called airdropping. I'll know all the holders. I'll know all the addresses that they have, and I'll just airdrop them special features or special new art that I'm releasing. So.
So you can deliver value through an NFT above and beyond just a JPEG of like a monkey or something. I think that's kind of the hang up for most people. So you're like, if you were doing a special, training session, let's say for your members, you could deliver that through an NFT or am I getting that wrong?
I love that you said that, because there's one guy out there who's really focused on making education NFTs. So here's the beauty, right? Let's say, George, you launch a course. Maybe you sell it for, you know, $1,000 US in value. If that community becomes more powerful or over time or super, super valuable, that could in fact double to $2,000 or $3,000, right? So now the beauty of that is whoever's part of your community, they're incentivized to continue to talk about what you have, the benefits of what you have, right? So you almost build an army of marketers with you, assuming that you build a great product. You know, now when you launch an educational thing, not only do you have a bunch of people promoting you, which increases the floor price of what you have, you can actually, your audience benefits from it, and you also benefit from the resale, the resales long term.
So they can sell the class. So let's say that I do a class on how to understand the Fed's balance sheet or quantitative easing or something like that, or inflation versus deflation. Then, so I sell it for $100 or whatever, and then XYZ person buys that. But then once they've watched it 100 times, they've memorized it. They say, okay, now I want to sell this to my friend. And then they sell it to their friend for, let's say, $90. So he gets a bit of a bargain, let's say, a sales price, and he buys it for $90 so he can watch it. But then into the contract, I've got it built into where when that next transaction happens, then I get $50 of the $90 or 50% or something like that. Is that how it works?
Yeah, I mean, you could make the royalty that high. Typically, it's not that high, but yes, it's at a very simple level. But also, here's the thing too. Like, again, like you have a community with Rebel Capitalist Pro, right? Yeah. If you have a very engaging community, like there's one membership card right now from the creator of Kevin Rose. He founded a company called Dig a long time ago.
Yeah, I remember. Yep.
And so, like, you know, I bought that one for 2 Ethereum, which right now that's valued about 6,200. The value of that card now, there's only 1,000 of them, is actually 91 Ethereum. So that's actually about $282,000 just for that membership card.
So the reason, what does that membership give you?
Yeah. So it gives you a Discord group where they share information on new drops that are coming out, and they'll give you early access to drops that they're doing, which they just did one recently that just did like $200 million.
What do you mean by a drop?
So a drop is when they have like new releases coming out, like new art coming out, new NFTs coming out. Yeah. Okay. So they just did $200 million, right? Or like in transaction volumes, I think 75 of it just went directly to them. So that's big, right? And so, you know, for them, it's just like the reason the card value kept going up was because of everyone in the community talking about all the value that they were getting, and the floor price kept going up. So ideally, if you're launching a course, you launch it with a community, and if the community is so good, people can't help but to talk about it. So the floor price actually goes up. So when they resell your course, it comes with the community, and that price actually goes up.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm better understanding it. So it's basically a smart contract.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just either a smart contract for a piece of art or education or whatever you want to put into that contract.
Correct. And here's the beautiful thing, like us thinking from an investor standpoint, we're going to be able to see in the next 5 to 10 years, who's really good at investing in this stuff. Cause you can just look at the contract and see like what they bought into really early. And you're going to be able to filter out the best investors out there. And you can just, if they start a fund, everyone's going to want to invest in these people, right? Because they just make the right calls. So
that's really interesting. So how would you do that if you were setting up a real estate fund, and what would be the benefit? Or is it even, I don't know if it's even legal, but assuming that it was legal, you're dealing with accredited investors and whatnot. How would you allow them? Because typically they would invest in the fund. You know, they just wire you $500,000 or whatever. So then they have either an ownership position or you know, they've got a percentage of the fund, or they, you know, there's a way to get that return. Is there an advantage to doing that through an NFT and using that technology?
I think I would actually remove the word NFT for simplicity's sake here and just think, just going back to the smart contract. Exactly. Right. So everything we do in the world, whether it's like, you know, a real estate deal or like investing into a fund, there's always contracts tied to it. Now it's just going to be seamless in the next probably 5, 10, maybe even 15 years or so. Just imagine you invest, they take your money, and then like when they're releasing distributions, it automatically just hits your account, right? Like I see that as a future. Maybe you'll have like real lawyers actually auditing this stuff, and you know, probably lawyers might need to work with technical people now, but that's just gonna be the future, right? So NFTs aside, because NFTs are a buzzword right now, you can just say like, yeah, let's make an NFT with it. But reality, what you're trying to do is you're trying to build smart contracts to just make the user experience easier across the board, right? Because there's so much friction. You would know, like you've invested in a lot of real estate. It's largely a pain in the ass. So,
yeah. I mean, it can be. I mean, it's kind of the same process. I've just done it in Colombia and Ecuador in the United States, and the time frame can be different. In Colombia, you know, you could close tomorrow if the seller agreed upon it. But you still have to go through the title company. They've got to get a lawyer to make sure that there's no liens on the title, and you know, all of these other things that usually take days, if not weeks. So, but it sounds like this is a way to do it. If you had a smart contract instead of a title, that doing this background research would be far more efficient and maybe more transparent, right?
Yeah. And the beauty too is like, let's say you look at someone that maybe doesn't have the best character, right? You can maybe look at the blockchain and look at all down the road, everything might go on the blockchain, right? Like, you know, any offenses that you might've, that you have, right? Any like liens or judgments against you, or like, you know, maybe your employment history, your education history, like everything can be on the blockchain and you can verify it very quickly to see if this is a fit or not a fit. And then you're just going to get I think you're going to be able to get things done a lot quicker. I think that's going to take time again. And, you know, there's a lot of people that are going to push back on it, but long-term, I think it works out. Here's the other thing too. Kevin O'Leary has talked about this. I mean, he's a lover of watches, and a lot of the watch companies want to tie NFTs to valuable watches, because if you steal a watch and you don't have the NFT with it, then that might prove that, you know, you don't have like the real version, right? You don't have the entire set. So like these watch insurance companies actually are thinking about NFTs for watches. So
that's really interesting, isn't it? I mean, you could do the same thing with antique car or collectible cars.
Yep.
So many things out there. I know that when I was, I don't know if you want to use the word investing, but I was kind of investing in cars back in 2017. One of the main things I remember with those older Corvettes is you would have to have the serial number on like the transmission to make sure it matched the engine and all these things. I don't know if there's a way to do that on an NFT, but if there was, it would be a lot easier, because that was a pain in the butt for sure.
It can happen. I can see it.
Yeah. So let's go into kind of some alternate media space, because I want to get your view on this. You know, what's going on with Twitter right now, that all the drama with Musk and, you know, free speech, and he's kind of on the side of, or at least he says he's on the side of not censoring anyone and just kind of absolute free speech. And then you've got a lot of the tech companies that are trying to censor through, you know, quote unquote, what is misinformation or disinformation. And they're the only ones that get to decide what that actually is. And they're kind of in bed with the government. And then you have all these other alternatives that are kind of popping up. One of them, you know, Rumble, that I've dealt with a little bit. Locals is something that I just hopped on maybe a couple weeks ago or so. And so what are your thoughts on that kind of alternative social media platform space right now?
Yeah, I think the beauty, especially in this country, is that you can just, this country being America, is you can, anyone can go out there and build something and try to get distribution. I know Trump released one recently called Truth, I believe.
Yeah.
But that one, I mean, from what I've heard, from what I've read about, like, he didn't exactly hire the best team. So the execution kind of fell flat, right? So if you have a great team behind it and then you can figure out how to get distribution, great. I think, you know, when, I can't really speak to Rumble and Locals, but when you think about a Twitter, the reason why Elon wants a Twitter is because they have distribution already. And it's just easier that way to just make sure, you know, really a lot of the stuff that we have problems with is just kind of policy, right? So I think the policy with Twitter, you know, banning people, I think whether you disagree with them or not, long-term, I think has long-term ramifications. So I do kind of see where he's coming from. So do I think, you know, these, you know, I listened to an interview recently with Mark Zuckerberg too. I think they have a very difficult job, you know, especially after like 2016, like things became a lot more complex for them, right? Yeah. So I think for these alternative social ones, like unless you have a really good algorithm, like a TikTok, like the reason TikTok works really well is because the algorithm just works, right? So I think it's much easier to create something, but it's much harder to kind of get that distribution. So I hope there are more competitors that pop up so we have a more competitive market. So that's where I stand right now.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the live conference I do twice per year with all of your favorite speakers from the Rebel Capitalist show and experts in investing, commodities, real estate, freedom, and liberty. All of your favorite topics, all of your favorite speakers. The next Rebel Capitalist Live is going to be in Miami. And tickets increase in price as we get closer to the event. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com right now to get your tickets to the next Rebel Capitalist Live. It's the conference you cannot afford to miss. It'll help you increase your financial freedom and, more importantly, your personal freedom. You'll get intel that you won't hear anywhere else. Past speakers have included icons in macroeconomics, investing, and personal freedom and liberty. People like Dr. Ron Paul, Robert Kiyosaki, Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Richard Werner, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang, and Robert Breedlove, just to name a few. So once again, go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now and get your tickets today. You're really neck deep in kind of the tech world. So I'd love to get your opinion on maybe some of the reasons why these tech companies, let's say Facebook or Zuckerberg, are so adamant about kind of misinformation or disinformation or maybe pushing a political narrative. And I want to give them the benefit of the doubt because to your point, you know, I've been in a business and I've scaled businesses from 5 employees to 25 to 50 to 100. And it's a whole different ballgame at 100 than it is at 5. And I don't think most people realize the problems that come along with running a business of 100, let alone 1,000 or 10,000 employees. I mean, it gets just the bureaucracy, the red tape, I felt like I was babysitting 100 employees. I'm sure sometimes you feel like you're babysitting 60 employees. I can't even comprehend having to babysit 10,000. You know what I mean? And so let me tell you a story, and I'd like to get your view on this and see if you've heard anything similar. I was listening to Sam Harris or you know, one of these people in the intellectual dark web. This was maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And it's really when this censorship with social media really started to become prevalent. And I think it was Sam, it might not have been, but he said that he recently had dinner with a top executive, maybe a CEO of one of these big social media companies. He couldn't name the name, but he had dinner with them in Silicon Valley. And again, this was maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And he said that this person disclosed to him that one of the main reasons why they're kind of between a rock and a hard place, meaning management, is because the employees, a lot of them are just batshit crazy. But the ones that are crazy are the ones that are extremely valuable to the company. So the CEO and the management gets in this position where they have to cater to their employees. And if their employees are off their rocker, you know, what are you going to do? If all your employees support Joe Biden, let's say, then you can't be a big Trump fan, even if you are, because then you lose all your employees and then you're screwed because you're kind of held hostage because they're doing all of the work. And the example this guy gave is that one of his key, I don't know if it was one of his software engineers, but he was a key employee. He was one of these people that think that he's a cat. Or likes to pretend to be a cat, like on the weekends, like a wonder kid or something like that. And the CEO said that he actually had to put a litter box in the employee bathroom to appease this person, or else the guy that thought he was a cat was going to quit. And he says, this is what I'm dealing with as a CEO in Silicon Valley. Do you have any insights on that?
You know, I mean, that's freaking hilarious. here's where I'm coming from. I think Facebook has over 100,000 employees now, right? So,
oh, wow. Okay.
I think the way I look at it is there's always 1% crazy, right? So if you have like 100 employees, maybe one person's crazy. But if you have 100,000 people, maybe 1,000 people are crazy, yeah. Right? And so like there's always
they could be key employees.
Yeah, 1,000, that's a small army right there, right? So it's a 1,000 can cause havoc depending on like what level of clearance that they have. So I think that ratio is always going to be there. It's almost like if you have 100,000 fans, 100,000 subscribers or so, there's probably 1,000 people that will give you like, you know, poor comments or like talk a lot of crap, right? It's always like that on social media. You see all the negative people, right? So I think I do agree that the job is really difficult for them because A, there's crazies in the company, but also like having to deal with the right and the left too, right? You can't please both sides. If you please one side, the other side goes crazy and then like vice versa. And so I think they're, to your point, they're kind of behind the eight ball the whole time. You know, pre-2016, pre-2017, everyone thought, you know, Facebook, Instagram, these were the darlings. And now it's pretty easy to kind of, they're very algorithmically based too, right? Like it's very easy to manipulate things just by like, what's the quote? If it leads, it bleeds, right? Mm-hmm. And so like, that's just how these systems are built. And I do believe long-term, like there's a VC that spoke of this, David Sachs. I do believe at a certain point, maybe in the future, maybe we can't do this anymore, but looking at these social media platforms as maybe utilities more, that might be a better way to look at them, right? So that's my take on it.
Yeah. So how strong do you think the network effect is of a Facebook, let's say? Because, you know, you always hear this, that they have a monopoly position. No one can possibly compete with them. And as, you know, Musk has said that he's a free speech absolutist. And I would say that for me, I'm almost a free market capitalism absolutist, you know, meaning that I get very hesitant to try to solve this problem of censorship with more and more government, right?
Yeah.
So I always kind of wonder that, is it true that Google has a complete monopoly that no one could ever disrupt, or Facebook as an example? Like, how strong is that network effect? Or is this something that we have just seen in the past? Therefore, we kind of have this recency bias where we extrapolate it indefinitely into the future. And maybe it's not so much of a monopoly or a position of strength because, as you know, the bigger you get, it's more money, more problems. You know, you just got different types of problems. So those smaller competitors do have an edge. There's pros and cons there of being a behemoth. And do you think maybe they don't have as much of an edge because the younger generations coming up, you know, they don't care about Facebook. They only care about TikTok, or they care about Snapchat or something like this. And therefore, you know, in the next 10 years, Facebook is just going to experience this kind of attrition because of the age demographic. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, the beauty of free market capitalism is people will put their money where they'll vote with their money. Network effects are very strong, right? There's a very good book called Seven Powers, and it talks about the seven powers of like the best businesses out there. Network effects are one of the seven powers. And, you know, when you think about Facebook, you know, what they're really good at is actually acquiring. They haven't really been good at building over the last couple of years, right? Like they've acquired Oculus, they've acquired Instagram, WhatsApp. They tried to acquire some of these other ones and try to build like TikTok competitors. Now here's the thing. We've seen this movie before, because MySpace was number one before. Back then there was Friendster. Like if the product starts to suck, then people will just vote with their attention, or they'll vote with their money too, or maybe both of them. And so right now TikTok is an amazing product because I don't use it a ton, but when I do log in, I can see why it's so addicting, because it's like video after video after video. And it's like everything that I'm interested in. Right. So that's a product that's working.
You say their algorithm gives them an edge, because they're delivering to your homepage pretty much exactly. They're reading your mind almost.
Correct. Yeah. And so that's just great product design. Right. So I think whoever creates great products over time are going to win, which is why, like Elon, if you look at the products that he's created over time, like whether you love him or hate him, he's like objectively added more value to society, right? And so that's how I look at it. I don't think it's a winner take all type of deal. And the SEC is paying a lot more attention to these acquisitions now. So I don't think it's going to be like a crazy monopoly, right? But I do think, you know, like a Facebook or a Google right now, like if we go into heavy inflationary times, like long-term, it's like those seem like pretty obvious, like inflation hedges, but this is not financial advice. So,
all right. So talk about Web3 and the metaverse. I mean, on this channel, I make fun of the metaverse all the time, but maybe there's something to it that I'm not seeing.
Yeah. So I come from a gaming background, right? And what is kind of bizarre to me right now is people paying like, you know, $2.5 million for land in a metaverse, because we don't even know what's going to stick. And games are typically very fleeting, right? People, again, once the attention goes to like the new hot product out there, the new hot game, people are going to move their attention over there, right?
Yeah, and this is not the first time. I remember back in Farmville. Remember Farmville?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying the metaverse is exactly like Farmville, but then there was something else after Farmville where it was like, you could have an avatar. What was it? It was... it was a big deal. It was a very trendy thing where you had this avatar. It was like some second world or something like that. But it's basically you could live your life as this avatar online. It seems very similar to the metaverse. Maybe this is just the new rendition of that. But
yeah, I mean, I'll tell you what, like, well, you know, when I used to play these massively online multiplayer games, MMORPGs like World of Warcraft or EverQuest, I've logged like 120 days, right? Or 70 days. Like this is like almost like a year of my life, like in these games. And so I know how these things are. And like, I've talked to the founder of Twitch, right? They sold it for almost $1 billion to Amazon. And we have the same take. I asked him, I was like, dude, like, what do you think about this? Like same type of thing that I just gave, right? It's like, we don't really know what's going to stick. And what seems to make a lot more sense is investing into the infrastructure of Web3. It's the stuff that powers Web3, right? Whether you're investing into like infrastructure startups or like these layer one tokens, like Ethereum, for example, right? Or Solana. So that's where I'm at with it. I think it's a bit too early right now. And typically with startups, what kills startups, the number one thing is typically poor timing, right? So I think metaverse is kind of out there, maybe next 5-10 years, we're going to see more practical use cases. And then Web3, to me, that encompasses crypto, that's like DeFi, that's NFTs, that's all the stuff that's being built right now. So I do believe in Web3. And here's the final thing I'll say on this. There will be no Web1, Web2, Web3. Like in 5-10 years, we're just going to say the internet again. Like we're just upgrading the infrastructure of the internet, the foundation of the internet. And I think it's cool. It's trendy to say Web3 right now. It's more so like a marketing term to me.
Yeah. And that might even be where you are too in Miami, because as of, you know, maybe a couple of weeks ago, I'd never even heard the term Web3. So being around people that are kind of neck deep in that tech space and the NFTs and the crypto, I think that it may seem a lot more popular than it is if you were in Kansas City, Missouri, or Iowa or something like that. But not to say that it's not a trend, because usually, as you know, the trends are set on the coasts.
Totally. I think it's, you know, New York's probably number one in terms of people that are building in this space right now. And then, you know, Miami is like a nice hub as well. And then LA kind of, you know, you see people building, like the entertainers building stuff too. And SF is still always good despite all the kind of exodus there. But like the final, the thing I'll say about kind of the Web3 trend is, a lot of the VC dollars are going here, right? Like for better or worse. And it does feel a lot like 1999. So, we'll see what happens.
You know, it's usually the cycle, isn't it? Where everything, this, whatever it is, web 1.0 or 2.0 or 3.0, everyone gets super, super excited about it. It's the future. It's this, it's this, it's this. And 99% of the businesses go bust and all these people lose money. But the 1%, that's your Amazon, or that those are the companies that really do last. And those are the ones that everyone was excited about. They just got excited about too many of them.
Yeah. I mean, look, if you look at investing right now, all of these startups in Web3 are because there's a Web3 stamp on it, are raising at least at like a $50 million, $100 million valuation. Like a .com
stamp, same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No revenue, right? Or something like, so for example, there's one startup that there's a very famous athlete that you and I both know. The startup's revenue is $6 million, right? And the valuation is $2 billion, right? So I can't invest at that valuation. So.
Right. Right. Exactly. All right. So let's talk about the podcast, because I have encouraged a lot of my viewers and listeners to create content around, you know, something you're passionate about. Most of my viewers and listeners are really passionate about free market capitalism, better understanding macroeconomics, Austrian economics, freedom, liberty, and, you know, small government, libertarianism, those types of things, maybe real estate. So I know that you and Neil have really built a very powerful podcast, and I know you probably started it at least back in 2015 or earlier, because I was listening to it when I was going to the gym, I think in maybe 2015, 16. So when did you guys start that? How have you grown it?
Yeah, I think we're coming up on 5 years now. And so,
I was listening to, I must have been listening to it then in 2017 or 18.
Yeah. Which, I mean, it was still quite a while ago, but I would just say, like, and thank you for listening. So right now we're at about 2 million downloads a month right now. And it's been, in terms of the growth, I could tell you what's been effective. And here's the thing I want to say too, at a very high level, advertising is getting harder. Marketing is getting harder. When you look at Facebook ads, or when you look at Google ads, what do you want to call them? Alphabet or Meta, whatever. The ad costs are going to continue to get higher, right? Like these are auction-based systems. And not only that, the privacy, like because of privacy, like a lot of the data that we're used to tracking before from like an advertising perspective, that's all going away. And so marketing's actually—
I didn't know that, harder. Eric. That's a big deal. That's a really big deal.
It's huge. And the point I'm trying to make with this is, like, because marketing is no longer on easy mode, we have to think about the areas where it's like, where is it like a blue ocean, right? Where it's not red ocean, super competitive. And so what's actually working in marketing today would be things like throwing a live event, like what you do, or doing podcasts, right? Or, you know, running podcast ads, doing influencer marketing, getting on other podcasts too, thinking about, you know, what social channels actually have good organic reach right now. So TikTok would be one, LinkedIn would be another one, right? The effort that you're putting into YouTube right now, like growing that audience too, email marketing, like those things that are harder to do, where the barrier to entry is higher, that actually makes me excited as a marketer, because it's harder now to do great marketing. And if you want to stand out, you have to go to where the blue ocean is, where it's actually harder. So I just want to preface it with that. And in terms of how we grew it over the years, I would just say what's been really effective for us is not having one day off, right? We do a daily podcast, you know, every single day we have one. Doesn't matter if I'm sick, Neil's sick, doesn't matter if he has a baby, doesn't matter if he gets married or whatever. We keep going. So the daily podcast, they compound over time. And then also we, if you are fortunate enough to have some type of owned audiences, such as an email list, initially when we launched our podcast, we would hit the email list, you know, every single time. We did that for about 2-3 months or so.
When you say you hit the email list, you would, so your podcast, which by the way, it's daily, but it's maybe 5 to 10, at least it used to be like 5 to 10 minutes.
Still 5 to 10 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you, through this podcast, you then drive people to an email list, and then you kind of, then you send an email to the list of each new podcast in addition to other content that they would find valuable. Is that, am I getting that right?
So what we did initially was Neil and I both had email lists. He had a really big email list, and we
Your business. Okay.
Correct. And so we would launch a podcast and then like hit the email list. And so you can do the same thing with your email list too. That's always been a super big help. That's also how he grew his YouTube channel to about like 1.1 million subscribers, just hitting his email list with new videos. When you do email, you focus it on whatever, like one promotion. You're not just launching like a newsletter with a bunch of links in there. It's just like one link. Now he does like three links or so, but it's all to his content. And so that helps a lot. And then also, collaborating and interviewing others such as yourself that have an audience and getting them onto our podcast, right? Like the collabs also help. And what we do is, like, let's say you come on the podcast, we might send you some assets afterwards, like with a video, maybe ask you to tweet it or share it somewhere. That way we can get more distribution and more awareness on it. And also doing interviews like this and talking about the podcast like we are right now, that's inevitably going to drag some people over. So the other thing I'll say too is, I have a friend, his name's Jordan Harbinger. He gets like 5-6 million downloads a month.
Yeah.
It's called the Jordan Harbinger Show. So he spends about $1 million.
Whenever I look at the rankings on like Chartable and whatnot, I always see him at the top.
Oh, so here's what he does. I mean, A, he's a great interviewer. B, he's got great guests. C, he spends over $1 million a year advertising on other podcasts, right? Because it makes sense. It's very native. It's like, you know, George Gammon, like you're talking, and it's like, by the way, you guys should listen to the Jordan Harbinger Show, blah, blah, blah. And that's been super helpful for him. So that's the stuff that really works out well.
So how is he monetizing a podcast that gets 5 million downloads a month?
Yeah, it's through
able to spend $1 million a year or whatever on advertising.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers work out because he's getting a couple million, and let's say he charges like, I don't know, I'm just going to make numbers up right now. Let's say he charges like a $40 CPM at $5 million a month. That's basically $200,000 in revenue. And so that might be 2.4 million, right? And then maybe he might have, 2 to 3x that, because he might have 2 to 3x, advertisers there. So if that's the case, then maybe he's making $7.2 million a year. So those are the economics.
Do guys that are maybe at your level or his level, are you guys using an agency to sell ads, or are you just doing that in-house? You're probably doing it in-house because of all your clients that would most likely want to advertise on your podcast. But how do most people do that? Do they, because I'm assuming they want to focus most of their time and energy on actually creating content
as
opposed to dealing, in like a sales position where you're trying to negotiate contracts and deals and whatnot.
So we're actually doing it in-house right now, Neil and I, but we've had a great advertiser, Dreamhost, for the last couple of years. That being said, we do have a lot of people that will hit us up asking, like for example, like a iHeartRadio might hit us up and say, hey, like, why don't we sell your ads for you? Let's do like a distribution. We'll take a percentage. You guys take a percentage. And like, they'll support us with back office stuff, like throwing events and promoting the events too. So there's that, right? Like, those are the options.
Did you guys do that deal with iHeartRadio?
No, we haven't. They'll reach out to us. We have a really good deal relationship right now. It's just easy. It's very hands off, and they trust us. But what I'll say too is, from a monetization standpoint, you can do advertising. For what you're doing too, like, you create content, you can do an event, right? Then you can do a mastermind tied to it, and then you might have other benefits too. Maybe you have like a fund, and maybe you can get investors too. So I think there's a lot of different ways to play it.
So it seems like, even though we're in 2022, the method is very similar to what it was. I mean, even before I retired, quite honestly, is that,
same thing.
You set up a great product where you deliver a lot of value, and then you just market that product by, getting as many in front of as many eyeballs as you possibly can. Back in the day, it was through television and radio, but today it's just through creating content that people find valuable, i.e. YouTube, blog post, podcast, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, look, you bring up a really good point here, George. It's if we want to talk about freedom, if you want to talk about the sovereign individual long-term, I think everyone needs to build an audience. And you build an audience, that's a moat that you have, and nobody can really take that away. Sure, you can get banned from these platforms, but once you build a big enough audience, you look at like a Logan Paul, right? He's like a huge name now. He started with Vine first. Now he's a big YouTuber. He fought Logan, Mayweather. And so he's done like a lot of amazing things, and you have to respect the hustle. And so when you're able to build that leverage, then you can truly become a sovereign individual and have more optionality. And so that's how I see it. Like, you know, Neil and I have always talked about this. It typically takes about 3 years to start to see traction with your audience, maybe 5 years to really start to see escape velocity. But it takes time, and most people aren't willing to do it because, well, it's hard work.
How do you look at the analytics to determine if what you're doing is if the way that you're creating content is most efficient to maximize on your objectives, right? Because, you know, you could start a YouTube channel and people 10 different people could have 10 different objectives. And how do they track what they're doing to maximize on maybe that 80-20 rule, right? Where 20% of what you're doing is getting 80% of the results, and keep doing more and more and more of what works.
Yeah, I'm going to use this in the context of YouTube, and I'm going to use you as an example compared to me. And you're a really good example, actually, because what you've done over the years, you're at what, like 350,000 subs?
Right around there, yeah.
Yeah. So George, he's focused talking about macroeconomics. Like, no matter what, he will talk about macroeconomics. It could be a 20 to 30 minute video. There's going to be three simple steps, right? And that's why he's grown so quickly to 350K, which is really impressive, right? Now, the reason my channel is only at 66,000 subscribers, if you look at me like 5-6 years ago, I was talking strictly about marketing, and my videos would just easily go to like 100-200K views or so, 50,000, you know, very easily, right? Because I was very focused on that, and because the bar was lower for YouTube. And then I started talking about other stuff. I'm going to talk about investing. I'm going to talk about this. I'm going to talk about this. The algorithm will punish you for not focusing. And that's like real life too. The real life will punish you for not focusing, right? And so that's what I think it is. Like, when you think about George Gammon, like talk about macro, right? When you think about Michael Saylor, it's Bitcoin, right? So one singular focus, and you should be able to compound and grow over time, because I've seen, like, as you're on your way up, what ends up happening is more people watch your video, the retention rate's higher, and then they start to recommend all your other videos, right? So I'm saying a couple of things right now. One, focus. Second thing, look at your retention rate. If your retention rate's like, you know, people are falling off at like 20-30% or so on YouTube, you probably have an issue. Right. And then, you know, other than that, optimize your headlines and then your thumbnails, right? This is on YouTube. But a lot of these practices apply to podcasting too. You can look at the retention rate in Apple Podcasts, and then you can test out different titles, you can test out different subjects, and you'll see what works and what doesn't, but you have to continually adjust.
Okay, last question, buddy. How have you learned to say no, and how do you continue to fine tune that skill? And because the reason I say this, because I'm sure you get pitched about a million ideas a day. And as an entrepreneur, I'm the same way. You know, you find the value in everything. You're optimistic. You're probably overly optimistic. You see, oh wow, I could make money there. And oh wow, I could make money here and here and here and here and here. And you realize you only have 24 hours in a day. So how do you like distill it down to what you really should be focusing on to get the highest ROI?
Yeah, it's incredibly hard. I think I've learned it really the hard way over the last 10 years or so. And so for me, it's, you know, again, looking like at a Michael Saylor, like he doesn't try to approach every single thing, right? It's just, I'm focused on Bitcoin and like, that's it. So for me right now, I'm largely just focused on my main business, which is the marketing agency. Like, we're just focused on hiring great people and building a great culture and, you know, trying to focus the company more on Web3. Like, that is the focus, right? And then the other stuff I do tied to events, like that is tied to kind of, that is kind of like a marketable, you know, moment in itself. That's not like I'm trying to do like a billion different things. Now, you know, I don't do our software company anymore. I don't try to do our education thing anymore. I just largely focus on the agency and anything that might add to the agency. That's all I do. And then other than that, my job is then I'm a capital allocator. And then I'm just, you know, looking at whatever I think is the future and making bets on, you know, I have one thesis, Web3 is the future, and I just focus on that. And so that's basically it. But it's, you know, I think people listening to this, like early in my career, I'm like, well, I'm very capable. You know, I think I'm a smart guy. I think I could do way more things than other people. But when you look at like a Warren Buffett, or when you look at like a, you know, Bill Gates back in the day, love them or hate these people, you know, they actually mentioned themselves, like, you know, what's the secret to your success? They both wrote one word on a piece of paper, flipped it over. It said focus. Bill Gates just focused on Microsoft back in the day. Warren Buffett just focused on investing in great companies and doing a lot of research there. That's it.
Yeah. You know, when you're saying that, it reminds me of one thing that made a huge difference in my success as an entrepreneur. And that I noticed when I would get focused on just making more money and more money and more money, sometimes I would stumble a little bit, because you have to dig beneath the surface and figure out, okay, what are the key components? What are the key metrics that actually equal me making more money? So don't focus on the money, but so what you're doing there, you know, you said you're just strictly focusing on hiring great people as an example. Mm-hmm. And what I would do back in the day is I would get hyper-focused on just the advertising. And when I was doing call to action advertising, just how many, you know, responses, how many leads we were getting, because I knew that if I could increase the leads, that the money would take care of itself. All yep. I have to do, you know, to your point, is you hire great people and make sure you got the leads coming in, and the rest, you don't have to worry about it. So you can, if you can get hyper-focused on just those two things, everything else will fall into place. And I think that's what so many entrepreneurs, they think that they need to focus on, you know, well, what type of insurance do we have? And, you know, what are we doing in HR? And then what are we doing in this and this and this and this? And they try to be on top of everything. If they could just distill it down to two or three things that they need to get hyper-focused on, that will create all of the other results that they're looking for.
Yeah. I mean, the final thing I'll leave you with is sales cures everything. So it's a Mark Cuban quote.
There you go. All right, buddy. Tell my viewers and listeners where they can find the podcast and everything else that you do.
Totally. You can follow me on socials, Twitter, Instagram at Eric O S I U. So it's Eric O Sue. The podcast is called Marketing School. And if you want to be entertained on YouTube, just search my name, Eric Sue S I U. And that's it.
Awesome, man. Can't wait to see you soon in Miami.
Yep. Likewise. Thanks, George.
Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Do you enjoy watching these interviews I do for the Rebel Capitalist Show? Well, if so, you would absolutely love Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the conference I do twice per year, and we've had speakers like Robert Kiyosaki, Lynn Alden, Rick Rule, Jeff Snyder, and Dr. Ron Paul, just to name a few. So go to RebelCapitalistLive.com and check out the next event we have scheduled in Miami.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.